Hi, I'm Claudia Fleming, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, Bomb Squad. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, the number one female-focused food podcast in the universe. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. On today's show, I'm sitting down with Sonoko Sakai, the cookbook author whose latest book is Japanese Home Cooking, Simple Meals, Authentic Flavors. It deserves to be an instant classic. Sonoko has an incredible story that involves lots of moving around as a child, working in the film industry as a grown-up, and ultimately finding her voice through food. Let's thank today's sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Schools and Emmy Cheese from Switzerland. You folks are the bomb. Some housekeeping. The official Cherry Bomb membership is finally here. For $25, you can become a card-carrying member of the Bomb Squad and enjoy special access to all things Cherry Bomb, like special member meetups. You only have a week or so left to get a founding member card, so don't delay. Visit cherrybomb.com for more. Another December 31st deadline, early bird tickets to our Jubilee Conference, taking place Sunday, April 5th in Brooklyn. Jubilee is the largest gathering of women in the food world in the United States, so don't miss out. It's a fun day filled with great talks, delicious food, and the best networking around. Tickets are $225 plus taxes and fees. Visit cherrybomb.com to snag your ticket. Before today's show, let's hear a word from our pals at Emmy Cheese from Switzerland. Hey, Bomb Squad, let's talk about Emmy Cheese from Switzerland. Emmy's beautiful variety of cheeses are crafted from the freshest milk from local Swiss farms. One of our favorites is Emmy Kaltbach Le Gruyère AOP. With notes of hazelnuts, black tea, and dried stone fruit, Emmy Kaltbach Le Gruyère AOP is the perfect addition to any cheese board. Or, if you want to get more creative, you can do what Chef Elizabeth Faulkner does and make her creamy farro with Kaltbach Le Gruyère fondue sauce. This wintry recipe combines fresh thyme, parsnips, and farro in a creamy bechamel fondue made with Kaltbach Le Gruyère. You can find this recipe and more at emmyusa.com. If you're looking for the perfect gift for the cheese lover in your life, check out Emmy's traditional Swiss cheese gift package. You can give the best of the best from Switzerland to friends and family with this package of five Emmy cheeses. This includes Emmy's popular Le Gruyère and some of their Kaltbach cave-aged cheeses, including the new Le Cremeux and one of my personal favorites, Gouda. Topping off the selection is Emmy's ready-to-serve fondue, making it easy to bring everybody together for a night of fun and melted cheese. Visit emmyusa.com/gift for details and use code radio to receive 10% off. Here's my conversation with Sonoko Sakai. There's so many places we can start, and we've got a lot to cover. The place I want to start, and Jess is going to laugh because I love to talk about people and their pets, is you dedicated your cookbook to your dog.
I know.
Who you lost a few years ago.
I know. I had the most amazing dog. You know, we rescued her, and she was with us for almost 18 years.
Tell us her name.
Anna. And it was the year that the Angels, the baseball team, won mm-hmm. the World Series. So my husband named her that, but she's a girl. And she was a human. She was like a human. She really understood, you know, and talked to you, and a very, very intelligent, kind dog. And oh my God, we gave her the most incredible funeral.
Aww.
My husband's a sculptor, and he actually built the most beautiful coffin. And we buried her at our ranch, but I covered it with flowers, lavenders that I grow, and we mourned for about 6 months or more. But it was hard. It was really hard. But I extended her life by a couple years making onigiri. And my husband would take it to the ranch with her because she felt better when she was at the ranch. She could run and chase the rabbits. And even when she was, like, starting to not walk that much, if she saw, like, a rabbit or a deer, she would just get up and run until she fell. And the onigiris were really great. And I would post those on Instagram, and people thought they were for humans. But I made the most incredible onigiri, and my husband wanted me to put a recipe of that onigiri in the book. But I already, you know, put more recipes than I was contractually allowed, so I just did it as a memoir.
What kind of dog was Anna?
She was a mutt. You know, she was like probably a little bit of pit, and we think it's like a blue heeler, but I don't know what she
did
was.
Did she keep you company in the kitchen?
Oh, yeah. She was so good. She's just, you know, she just waited. She never like took away food from your hands. I had a husky that would bite you and eat the bread or anything. And I have two cats, too, or I had three, but I lost one. But, yeah, they just are constantly begging for food. She wasn't like that. She waited.
You're an equal opportunity animal lover.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I love all animals, too. I didn't tell our radio producer this. I came very close to adopting a dog the other week, and I thought the better of it. Only because I travel so much right now.
Yeah.
And I have the world's most wonderful cat who is almost like a human. And I was like, she's enough work right now.
Oh, my God. I just got a text from my husband who's like, I'm leaving for the ranch. And by the way, you should really get someone to take care of the cats because I don't have time.
Thanks, honey.
Oh, my God. You know, I'm just making sure she has water. They have water. And
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I had to send somebody over. That's good. That's okay.
Do you cook for the cats?
No, I just give them Bonito flakes, you know.
Oh, that's I never thought to give my cat Bonito
oh
flakes.
Oh, my God. They love Bonito flakes. And if you go to a pet store now, you could pay like $25 for a bag of Bonito flakes that you could buy at a Japanese grocery store for like $6.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Okay. I'll see if Dusty likes Bonito
flakes.
Oh, they
flakes. Love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good tip. Thank you, Sunoco. Okay. So also reading your intro, you grew up all over the place.
Yeah.
San Francisco, Mexico City, on and on. Why did you travel so much as a child?
Because my father worked for Japan Airlines, and he was one of the first generation of executives to be sent overseas to work and, like, open the route, reconnect the route between Japan and the rest of the world. And so he came to New York before Japan Airlines was even flying here, and I was the firstborn American child of five children.
So you were born in New York City?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Where did you live in New York?
Kew Gardens.
Okay.
And my name, Sunoco, is actually child of the garden.
Was it difficult as a child moving so frequently?
Yes, it was, because every 3 to 5 years, my parents said, okay, it's time to move again. But I was a curious one of the five kids, and because I was a girl, not a boy, the boys were sent to boarding schools or they went to live with their relatives, and the three girls say, you're just coming along, you know, because eventually you're going to be groomed to be a wife and just stay with us. So they never even thought of putting us into boarding schools. So we say it's a sink and swim situation because we went from one language, you know, culture to another, you know, English, Spanish, Japanese, English.
How many languages do you speak today?
Three.
You wrote something beautiful about your mom in the introduction. You said, I watched my mother maintain a Japanese kitchen wherever our family lived, which was often a challenge. She was an ingenious and resourceful cook who managed to make Japanese meals without having access to Japanese ingredients. I loved that because I feel like people think today you need this huge pantry to make all these different types of foods.
No. When my mother actually walked into the New York kitchen, you know, my father was like a bachelor for a little while, and she walked in with my baby brother, and all she saw in the pantry was a bottle of soy sauce. And what she saw was these empty aluminum foil, containers
takeout
of takeout containers or Sara Lee's frozen dinners. And he basically
your dad was eating frozen dinners?
Oh, yeah, in the oven. That was like the modern
thing to do in the 50s. Right?
Yeah, but he just poured some soy sauce on it, and he said, that's good enough for me. That's Japanese food. But, you know, back then it was harder. We waited for those care packages to come, you know, but my mother made do without a lot of things that I actually have access to these days. It's amazing what you could have today.
Oh, absolutely. Do you remember when you say that she set up a Japanese kitchen, what did that mean back then?
Basically, that means that she had a rice cooker. And I was born on the year that the rice cooker was invented. I'm not going to even tell you what year that was, but it was in the 50s, you know? And so that was like a godsend thing for her. And yeah, so if you have rice, then and Japanese culture is basically a rice culture. You know, all our fermented seasonings are made with rice, sake, miso, vinegar, right? And we eat rice, and that's the centerpiece. So everything else is basically something that is enhanced the flavor of rice. So with rice, we were in good shape. Maybe it wasn't always short grain rice, but.
Do you remember your mom's specialties?
My mom's specialty, lasagna with rice.
No.
No, seriously.
She made lasagna with rice?
Yes.
Okay, walk us through that.
Oh, my God. I don't talk about it in the book, but she actually learned how to make pasta. Probably from like meeting an Italian person here, and it's cheesecake pasta and apple pie. Lasagna was one of her specialties, and she made the bechamel sauce, and she made a tomato sauce without garlic because garlic is not non-existent in Japanese traditional cuisine. And even when we lived in Mexico, she just didn't like the flavor of garlic. So we had a good garlic-less lasagna with rice. But plenty of cheese and bechamel sauce.
Was the rice in the lasagna or on the side?
On the side.
Oh, on the side.
But we made huge mounds of rice and the lasagna. And
I love it.
If she served lasagna without the rice, we didn't think it was complete.
Oh, that's so funny. Okay. So don't get excited, people. There's no recipe for lasagna in the cookbook.
No.
But there are a lot of other wonderful recipes.
Yeah.
Lots of them. And the book is so gorgeous.
Beautifully photographed by Rick Poon. Yeah.
And it feels as much travelogue as
cookbook. Yeah. For me, it was kind of like honoring the people that had provided the food, the ingredients to me in California. So I wanted to explore that further, deeper. You know, the rice farmer, Kota Farms, or the people that harvest seaweed. And it's not something that they have recently started. They've been doing this for decades. I just didn't know that. There was a history of seaweed cultivation. So as I explored these areas, I learned so much in my travels.
Seaweed certainly is having a moment, though.
Isn't it? Yeah, I think in a good way. I think it's an alternative to, it's maybe a cure for what our planet is facing. You know, we could make our planet healthier if we actually depend not only on the land foods, right? More sea vegetables, uh-huh. And vegetables.
Uh-huh.
And Japanese have been eating, depending basically on seafood for, hundreds and thousands of years. And I eat seaweed every day. So I'm trying to encourage people to incorporate that into their cooking. That's a very easy way into Japanese cooking, by the way. Yeah.
And you already get dried seaweed. You can get dried seaweed pretty much any supermarket these days.
Yeah.
But I often wonder about fresh seaweed.
Yeah, you could see them. They're salted in the fresh section.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say fresh wakame, some of the other varieties. I think people in harvesters in Maine are even offering fresh seaweed. So maybe not to the consumers too much, but I think it's going to start happening. Because, it's very nourishing. We're just learning. It's more actually healthier than land plants.
My mom thought I was crazy, but when I was in Maine a few summers ago and we were walking on the beach, I had, for some reason, I was like, I just know we can eat that seaweed. And I picked it out of the water and just ate it. And my family was like, you're kind of crazy. And I was like, no, it's not crazy. You know, we had gone on a foraging class and learned how to forage wild blueberries and different kinds of roots and things. And I was like, this is no different from what we just learned.
Yeah.
And it was a type of seaweed that anchors itself to rocks.
Oh.
And it was beautiful. It was like a sea lettuce.
Oh, yeah. They are so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's colonies of them in different, right? Different varieties. And the wild nori is like on the rocks. And when I was in north of Mendocino in California, I went to this beautiful, like a tide pool, and we went harvesting, but I've never seen such beauty. And they're amongst like the anemones and the crabs and, the sea urchins, and they're all sort of, an ecosystem that supports each other. So if you take one thing away or too much of one thing, then it's not gonna survive. Yeah, so when we were harvesting the wakame, the harvester was telling us, okay, just don't pull out the root. You have to just trim it and then let the seaweed regenerate itself. And so I never learned that in Japan. I just see them hanging, right? And this is where I actually, for the first time in my life, see how seaweed is harvested. It's amazing.
And how about rice? You said people have been harvesting seaweed for a long time. You just didn't necessarily know them. I know of some folks down south growing rice.
Oh, yes, yes.
But how widespread is rice production?
Well,
in
you
this
know,
country?
The Japanese Americans is one example of people that have been growing rice in California since the early 1900s. And it turns out that Kota Farm is the oldest mm-hmm. farm family that has been growing Japanese-style rice. They had to actually breed it in a way that would grow in that particular area of Dos Palos, California. But Kenzaburo Koda happens to come from the same village of my family, my paternal side of the family. And one of my uncles was on the same boat to America. Kenzaburo Koda stayed. My uncle went back to Japan. He didn't like America too much. Kenzaburo became the king of rice king. And to this day, you know, three generations later, they're known to grow some of the best rice, medium grain, Japanese-style rice. And that's the rice that I use. And I actually talk about the story that my mother would buy that rice and take it to Japan as a souvenir. Really good rice. And we actually reunited in the 60s. My father went to visit Kenzaburo, and Kenzaburo was inviting young Japanese farmers to show how he was growing rice in America in big scale, right? Thousands of acres. But it's an amazing family story because they had lost a lot during the war. They lost thousands of acres during the internment camp. And when you talk to any Japanese American person that's been here for, two, three generations, they have that dark period where they lost a lot of their belongings, their farms and nurseries. But they persevered, It's called gaman, perseverance. And they're just an amazing group of people. And when we moved back to America in the 70s, they were very kind to us. And a lot of the traditions that I thought I had lost or Japanese people had lost were actually preserved by these people. We were even the language. Like I was saying to my mother, God, they speak a Japanese that's very old-fashioned. So it's just like they were like frozen in time,
Wow. Did you have relatives here during internment?
No. My family went back, so they were in Japan. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your childhood in America. Let's fast forward to you as an adult.
Yeah.
You worked in the film industry.
Oh, my God, yes.
It's a big leap, but
I know,
let's go there because we have a lot to cover. So how did you get into the film world?
Well, I was actually in education, and my idea was I was going to become a diplomat or work in foreign service or work for UNESCO. Or I had, like, these big international dreams because I had traveled so much.
International
relations,
right.
And it's, like, the most obscure major in college, but I just thought that because of my upbringing, I could do something international, but I didn't know what that would be. But I decided to go into education, and I was working on my PhD at UCLA, but my parents cut me off. They said, we're not paying for grad school. If you want to go to grad school, pay it yourself. We have four other kids to support.
That wasn't so cruel.
No.
It's not you off.
No, they said, it's time for you to come back to Japan. We'll arrange a marriage. You'll meet the best potential husband. You don't have to be the foreign service person. We will find a diplomat you can marry,
They were still banking on you being a housewife?
Oh, yeah.
Even then?
Of course. Well, that's what people, parents of conservative families would expect their daughters to become, right? Like a school teacher or something. But they wanted me to come back to Japan because I was the eldest. And I said, no, I'm not coming back to Japan. So I had to find a job, and I found it in film school. And this professor was just Lou Stillman took me under the wing. He had won 2 Oscars in documentary filmmaking and just showed me his archives of beautiful photography and books. And here I was just being an assistant, but I also cooked for him. Like, I would bring him bento boxes and, make him miso soups. And he's like, God, you cook so well. And I was also at the same time trying to find my voice in English. I was still not, I didn't have the confidence to express myself in English. So he says, well, maybe you could find your voice through cooking. Why don't you write a cookbook? And so I started writing a cookbook, and that was the cookbook I wrote 35 years ago called The Poetical Pursuit of Food, Japanese Recipes for American Cooks. And it was the most esoteric book you've ever seen. but there was a lot of poetry in it, and I've always liked to bring
literal poetry.
Yes, yes. Like quoted different poets or something and had illustrations in it. And I think I was ahead of my time. People didn't even, I actually was invited to New York to do a TV show to make miso soup. And the host actually turned his head when I made the bonito flake dashi stock, you know, because it's fishy.
It's fishy the point.
For like 7 or 8 in the morning to make that soup. Mm-hmm. They weren't used to that. So he didn't appreciate it. And I just saw that expression. I go, oh my God, you know, it's just not, I'm just like, I have a long ways to go to convince people that Japanese home cooking is really delicious. But, you know, today I teach cooking and, you know, there's so many people that just love.
Yeah, when did the tide start to turn?
Well, it took a long time because I wrote that book when I was in my early, late 20s, early 30s is when I came out and I got
married. Tell us the title again. Could people find it on eBay?
Oh, yeah,
or
you could. Yeah, it's quite a collector's item now. It's called The Poetical Pursuit of Food.
The Poetical Pursuit of Food.
Yeah, it's not political. Okay. It's poetical. And it's a tongue twister. Poetical Pursuit of Food, Japanese Recipes for American Cooks.
Okay, so get on eBay, everybody.
Yeah, and it's a Potter imprint. And
oh, it's Potter, wow.
Yeah, it was a really good book. It's over 300 pages. And, you know, a lot of the commandments and things I wrote in that book is still basically the same things I believe in.
Okay.
I just got older and more mature, and I see things a little bit differently. But
how so?
First of all, I see things differently because I have more experience as a cook. As a cook, I've traveled a lot. I've tasted different foods. I've gone back and forth and picked up on things and learned how to put my hands in flour and make noodles from scratch. Or if you go back to that original book, you just see me doing recipes, right? I didn't make the fermented rice bran base, you know, in the way I do it now.
Or do you make every component now?
I do every component because it's possible and people want it. Like, I mean, my fermentation class, oh my God, they know more about me. It's like, do you have a koji room and do you like inoculate your rice? And I go, no, you know. Like, my husband's a sculptor and he, you know, has his little, you know, temperature control room for his epoxy. But I said, why don't you build me a fermentation box? You know, it's so easy for you. Just make it yourself, you know. So I've learned to do a lot of things.
You are a DIY queen.
Yeah, before that word was invented. My grandma was that way. People in the old times, they all did it that way. You don't have to be an artisan to be an artisan. Everybody did things. I think all of us, right? All our grandmas did that because they didn't have the convenience of fast foods or, you know, if you didn't make your own pickle, you didn't have the pickle like umeboshi, you know, pickling plums. So that's what I grew up watching. And I wanted to figure out a way to do that on my own. Yeah.
So you do this cookbook, but you're still pursuing a career in film.
Oh, yes. So I was thinking, do I pursue food? Because I had written this cookbook. But, you know, I had just had a one-year-old baby, and my husband's a sculptor. We're both struggling. I didn't have a washer or dryer going to the laundromat. And I said, I think I have to, like, just continue my work and in film. And I was basically a gopher, you know, like a secretary. And because I speak these different languages, I found my way into selling movie rights to the international market. And that's how I got my foot into the door. But and so that just became the more serious. But my parents didn't think it was a good career to pursue because they said, why don't you get a real job, a film job? You know, why don't you just like, why do you drop out of UCLA? I said, well, I couldn't afford it anymore, you know? And I just had to be more practical. So
any big moments from your film career?
Well, I produced several films and they kind of all flopped. But the last one was, I was actually proud of it. It was called Blindness. And the book was written by Jose Saramago, who won the Nobel Prize, yeah. And it was Julian Moore and Mark Ruffalo and Gael García Bernal and directed by Fernando Meirelles, who did City of God. And, you know, it was like a dream project. But it got released in Cannes, opening film. The timing was bad because my film opened on the week the market crashed. Mm. October 2008, I think. And it was very unfortunate because the Chihuahua, Beverly Hills Chihuahua, was a huge hit. People wanted to go to comedy. They didn't want to see a dark film about the epidemic of blindness. And that's what we were suffering from. We were suffering from the epidemic of not seeing. It was all about greed, and the greed was winning. And it was too close to the reality, and the movie was dark, you know? But it was a major, it was a big movie that just didn't work commercially. And I just dug a big hole, and I was like, I thought I should jump into that hole because it was hard. I was, you know, as a producer, you're raising money and you have a lot of responsibility, so much pressure. And I just said, okay, I have to find a way to heal myself. And what I did is I went back to cooking.
We'll be right back with Sunoco Sakai after this quick break. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. There's a beautiful Japanese restaurant called Kamo Negi in Seattle.
Oh, she's my friend.
Oh, is she? She has those beautiful videos of making noodles.
Mutsuko Soma. Yeah, she contacted me. She found me online, and she was trying. I was doing already some soba, and she says, "Where do you get your flour?" And I said, "Right from Washington, where you are." And so I introduced her to the producer, and we actually went to the region where a lot of the buckwheat is grown and actually exported to Japan. So she says, "Oh, maybe I could get a mill and I could keep that buckwheat here." And so the two of us, we started like collaborating with each other, and she came out to LA for a month and worked with me on my pop-up, and then I would go up there, and we work with the Bread Lab, WSU Bread Lab, where they have cultivated over 150 varieties of buckwheat. So we are both sort of grain geeks, you know, soba geeks. But she's doing very well, and I'm so happy for her because she's still in her mid-30s, and she's taken this quite seriously, and she's this tiny little person, but she has so much energy. And I have one of her, the natto, you know, fermented soybean recipe in the book, and she has a natto soba that's all gooey.
Oh, I didn't try that one. Oh. I tried the Kamo Negi dish.
Oh,
the,
yeah,
the
one with
signature
the,
dish with
yeah,
the duck.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She's good. Good. It has a great atmosphere, too, right?
Absolutely. And it's a quirky space.
Yeah, and she renovated all by herself. I saw her painting.
Amazing.
Like,
amazing.
She's and her husband is an artist. They're a really creative couple.
Well, tell her the Bomb Squad sends their love from
yeah,
afar. We can't
yes,
wait to come back.
Definitely.
Absolutely. So we have barely talked about this gorgeous book, Japanese Home Cooking, Simple Meals, Authentic Flavors. Mm-hmm. What made you want to write your third cookbook?
Well, the second one is a tiny little kind of a gifty book, but it was a way for me to get back into writing, and I thought onigiri is a good place. But I've been thinking about wanting to write another Japanese home cooking book because I just didn't see anything out there in the market that really covered the pantry in the way that I felt needed to be covered, clear instructions, illustrations. And so I've been dreaming about it for 30 years. I've come up with so many different angles and titles. But, you know, I was deeply involved in movies, right? But I was always cooking. I never stopped cooking. So I didn't go out and do something else. I've always done what I've done. But after I left film, I started teaching. So I spent some
in your home.
Yes, mm-hmm. I started with the noodles because I really got involved in noodle making, and then I thought, okay, I bring that back. And then when you do noodles, you also have to do the soup. The soup is the dashi. So you basically have to really understand the fundamental of the Japanese pantry and the seasonings and the stock. And so I said, well, this is my learning process is something that could be also converted into a teaching thing. So, and because I needed to find a way to make a living again, I thought, oh, I'm going to start teaching some weekend classes and, you know, ask my friends to come and see if they can guide me. And it just like started to grow and in an amazing way. But I would pack my Prius with like my pots and pans and travel 400 miles to, you know, all over to go to San Francisco, fly to Seattle where my son is, and travel to Chicago, and started just like sleeping on people's couches, but also like, and bringing all my equipment. But then people started to take me serious. It took me 10 years though. It's a long process. It's not glamorous like the movie business. It's very, very low key, but there's something very sincere and, you know, honest and delicious about it that I kept going. And I realized that I'm at an age that, you know, you can't be a chef at, you know, the age that I am, but I could.
You mean a restaurant chef?
Yeah, like a serious restaurant. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be, I thought of maybe a little soba shop or something. And, you know, like Soma Mutsuko from Kamonigi and I talk about, well, what could be good for me, you know, but put that aside for now. But I'm just happy teaching. And I am at my grandmother's age when I first walked into her kitchen. So, and I have a lot of energy, you know, because I...
We can tell.
You could tell, right? Like, I'm like, Claire, my publicist can't believe that I've been doing all these demos and I'm still at it, you know? So I know I could maybe live long, like my grandmother who lived to 102. And
she did well.
Yeah, she was cooking till 100.
Wow.
So I still have, you know, several decades to go.
So tell us the best way to approach your book, because not every book is front to back.
If you're going to start, I devote a lot of time in the fundamental part, you know, the pantry. So I said I teach every weekend, and a lot of people who never taken Japanese classes before, but what they do is they come into my pantry, they come into my kitchen, and they look at the shelves full of fermented stuff, and they smell something different. And I want them to become familiar with that, you know, and not feel intimidated. And they go, oh, that's just soybeans and salt and water put together, and you can make miso in 6 months. Wow, that's not too bad. Or, you know, you just, a lot of these pickles are pretty simple, actually. It's just salt, right, or vinegar. And Japanese spices and seeds, we don't have that many spices. Curry's an exception, but that's an imported food that came later on. But if you look at the five basic seasonings, it's miso, salt, vinegar, soy sauce, you know, it's like, and sake meaning, you know, is the fermented five seasoning that's made with rice except for the sea salt. And other than that, we don't really use that much, maybe a little chili and some wasabi and ginger, but our cooking is about respecting the ingredient, the natural ingredient. So I don't like to fuss with a fresh fish or a beautiful tomato. If we have the chance of just eating it sliced and raw, that would be priority number one. And then that's what my grandmother used to say about fish. You know, we live by the sea, so we would go and get the fish directly from the fishermen out of the nets when they're still alive and come back and make sashimi with it. But if it stayed, you know, in the fridge for a day, then we go, oh, let's grill it or let's simmer it. So she had she had like the different techniques, but five techniques that I would interchangeably use. And I talk about the principles, the five different principles. But so, you know, I want you to go through the pantry and read. You should spend a lot of time in the pantry, I think. With any, I think, cuisine, you have to learn some basics and then go visit a market and, you know, call me if you have questions. and then I, using that basic five seasonings and the principles that I go through, then you could, I have pantry recipes. I call them okazu, but okazu means a number of dishes. And what we like to do in Japan is you have your basic grain, a bowl of grain, like rice, and then you have side dishes. So it's the centerpiece is never a big piece of steak You know, it's not a huge piece of protein. Actually, it's the grain with the vegetables, and then you have maybe a little piece of fish. So you make a variety. You know, we like variety of dishes, and I think it's more nutritious. And so what I do in the pantry section is to give you some simple dishes that you can work with using dashi, the stock.
Is there a recipe that is really close to your heart?
They're all kind of close to my heart, but just start with miso soup. Miso soup is what I make every day for my husband. Without miso soup, he can't start his engine. And I think it's a breakfast food that's very nourishing and it's easy. You could do a cold brew with kombu and just make miso soup. If you could learn how to make a good stock, you've actually captured, you understood 50% of Japanese cooking. And just throw him some vegetables. My husband makes his own miso soup now. Broccoli every day. I say, why do you eat so much broccoli? He says, I just have to chop it up. It's too much trouble to find other vegetables. I said, I can't believe it. But anyway, he likes his miso soup. And when he comes back from the ranch, I make him a more interesting, you know, miso soup. But I just think that soup is very important.
Before you go, and I know you have to leave in a few minutes, we did not talk about your grain activism.
Oh, yes.
You call yourself a grain activist. What does that mean?
When I was pursuing my interest in buckwheat and soba noodles, I met Glenn Roberts from Ensign Mills and also people like Steve Jones from the Bread Lab. But Glenn said, you know, why don't you get some farmers to plant some heritage grains, and including buckwheat, and California and Southern California, because nobody's doing it. Most farmers in California are busy making cash crops that are like fruits and vegetables and nuts. But California used to be a grain growing region. And after the Industrial Revolution, everything moved west. And so this is a chance for us to revive this industry, which could also serve as these grains could serve as a cover crop, as a rotation crop. And actually where I have the ranch in Tehachapi, they used to grow rye and wheat, and you could see fields of rye, wild rye that we actually harvested and we made bread with it, and it was so delicious. So we started an experiment with a handful of farmers, and that was about 11 years ago. And today, it's you could find the grains at the farmer's market, and people
Amazing.
Are milling and using.
What towns?
Tehachapi. Oh, mm-hmm. The Hollywood Farmers Market. The Santa Monica Farmers Market, like the Tehachapi Grain Project is the ones that I was really involved with. And Alex Weiser, the farmer from Weiser Family Farm, said, I don't know, but why don't we experiment with one row and we'll learn with each other. We'll invite people, chefs and, you know, bakers to see if it grows. You know, we had no idea what we were growing, you know, but Glenn gave us really, a bruisey rye and red fife and Sonora wheat that was actually from the Southwest region. And, you know, these names and that of grains that we've never really, you know, worked with before, but they're amazing. And
oh,
I think
wonderful.
It has changed the flavor of bread and noodles.
Wonderful. And we're going to do a little speed round before we officially let you walk out the door. Favorite kitchen utensil?
A strainer.
A treasured cookbook in your collection?
My first cookbook.
Good answer. Song that makes you smile?
A mariachi song. I grew up in Mexico, so, you know, there's songs like Cielito Lindo. It's a mariachi song, but that's one of the first songs I ever learned how to play on a guitar, so, you know, it makes me happy.
Amazing. All right, we'll jump to the last one. If you had to be trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be?
Maybe I would pick Hosokawa, my soba master. But he would be very grouchy, I don't know. But he would be complaining the entire time about, you know, something not being fresh enough. But if it's on an island, maybe we could fish together or something, yeah.
You're remarkable. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Sonoko Sakai for stopping by. Be sure to pick up her beautiful new book, Japanese Home Cooking, at your favorite indie bookstore. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Schools and Emmy Cheese from Switzerland for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. Be sure to subscribe to Radio Cherry Bomb wherever you get your podcasts. You can also rate and review the show and leave a suggestion about future guests, future topics, anything you like. Our show is edited, engineered, and produced by Jess Seidman. Cherry Bomb is powered by Audrey Payne. Kia Damone, Donna Yen, Maria Sanchez, Nancy Pappas, and our publisher is Kate Miller Spencer. Our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra La La. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hey, I'm Lee Kalpakis. I am a freelance recipe developer and cook in New York City. And you know who I think is the bomb? Doña Angela. I love her cooking show on YouTube, De Mi Rancho a Tu Cocina. Doña is such a warm and sweet personality, and her traditional Mexican recipes are incredible. Watching her is totally mesmerizing, and I cannot get enough. So thanks, Doña.